I don't know how many of you know about George MacDonald. How many of you have ever heard of him or have read anything about him? He's a preacher of the last century in England who was gifted with a passionate imagination. And by passionate, I mean it passionate. That is, it was a fiery, consuming kind of gift that he had. And although he was very, very deeply devoted not only to his parishes that he served, but also completely won to the discipleship of the Lord Christ. He never satisfied any parish. And I thought it's kind of interesting that Carol had that Bible study this morning on the imagination and the effect of the imagination on most congregations is that of withdrawal and a general kind of not dislike, actually, but a feeling that it's really not in place in church. That imagination doesn't belong. That you might be drawn into heresies, and better that we stay with the small catechism and the question and answer method that we learned, and don't get off the road, because just like at Holden, if you get off the trails, you get lost in the woods. And this is exactly what does happen in many of George MacDonald's stories, actually. People do get lost in the woods, and this is how they finally find their way to truth. That unless you really are willing to get lost and almost get buried, you never come to life. I get sort of disgusted, actually, with people assuming that this is Luther, because if anybody had imagination, it was Martin Luther. I always feel like the preachers and the some of the worthies in congregations who stalk around and talk piously and ponderously about imagination not being Lutheran. That's all right for the Episcopalians and the Catholics, but not for the Lutherans. I didn't think they'd ever read Luther. They couldn't have. Because when you read Luther, his sermons and his Bible studies, his lectures on one and all of the New Testament books and the Old Testament too, are full of imagery. And it's not all about the Pope. It isn't all just, you know, kind of a, well, of course, we've read Luther. We know how he talked about the Pope. Terrible, wasn't it? You know, of course the Pope deserved it. That kind of thing. But there was a lot of other imagery in Luther. And his imagination was not at all governed by the nice thing to say. He was steeped so in Scripture that he spoke with scriptural imagination. And as Carol said this morning, Jesus' own use of the very earthy elements of our lives, which certainly shouldn't be sort of looked down on, was a part of Jesus' imagery, and certainly was a part of Luther's, as well as the delightful and glorious parts of our lives, which was also a part of Luther's imagery. So I think there's a real lack of understanding of Luther. I'd like to say that, but actually I think it's just people never opened those books. We've got a whole row over there. Beautiful red-bound volumes of Luther that nobody ever reads unless maybe he or she is going to give a matins, or maybe going to give a discussion, or maybe somebody's going to have to look up a Bible text and they better find out what Luther said. Nobody nobody ever reads him, and he's got just as much kick and fun and excitement as any modern devotional writer I've ever read. Well, with that very belligerent beginning, I didn't mean to get off on that tack, but I have heard this said, and I just happen to think, well, sometimes I think people who come to Holden need some ammunition when they go back. And sometimes you need to throw a few balls at people that are saying, well, that's kind of what are you doing discussing literature and philosophy and, why don't you just read the Bible? Well, sometimes the people who are saying that don't read the Bible or anything else. They're satisfied with, God's minute. A neat little thing with a Bible verse at the top and a neat little three paragraphs that kind of give you a little vitamin pill for the day, and that's it. And you close it up and you go along your merry way. And of course, God's going to take care of it because His word never returns void. Well, I think that's a dangerous proposition. But anyway, we do sometimes have to give a reason for why we do the things we do, why we read the things we do, and why we're interested in talking about the things we do. Because otherwise, people would say, very easily, well, you weren't talking about any race crisis, or you weren't talking about the peace problem. What were you talking about that was important then? Well, it's amazing. But the life of the imagination has a great deal to do with the shaping of any society. And George MacDonald is a person who is very much that kind of person. I suppose if I mentioned one person in the 19th century England who is considered a great social writer in the world of fiction, I'm sure somebody would come up with a name. Can somebody think of one writer that really was concerned about the people, the children who were put in prison, the children who were sold into the meanest kind of work in the factories, the problem of the debtors' prisons, people that never could get out of those prisons? Can anybody think of what book? Charles Dickens, sure. Full of it. Just full of it. There's nothing, he just goes through every book that he's written. And I'm sure that we all admit that without the imaginative work of somebody like Charles Dickens, the conscience of the English people would have been much less likely to move in the direction of change. But I don't put Charles Dickens in the category of the Christian imagination. I think he was motivated by a strong moral fervor, but to me, there's nothing particularly or peculiarly Christian in what he's writing about. I think he's writing about the fruits of Christianity, what should happen when Christians are active, and he's pointing up the needs of a society. But the actual life of the Christian is certainly not evident in Charles Dickens. And if you read his life, I think you will find a good deal to sort of bear out that idea. But George MacDonald is another sort of kettle of fish, if you want to call it that, because he is a man whose imagination was captured by Christ and who was continually concerned with bringing out in the most subtle way the needs for change, the importance of a life of the Spirit, the excitement of living in the life in God. And he did it in such an interesting way that a lot of people didn't know he was writing about it. And you know, that's very clever. If you can write a religious book, and people don't know you're writing a religious book, you really got them trapped. That's why I think Holden is kind of a good place, because a lot of people, of course, I know when they read the Holden highlights, they really get the idea it's religious, and then they come up here and they say, you know, this isn't really the way we thought it was going to be. It isn't nearly so religious. And of course, they don't understand the kind of track they're in. But this whole kind of form of Christian writing, in which you use another way of saying the Christian truth, is what George MacDonald's father and his children in the world of writing were people like C.S. Lewis and Charles Williams and Dorothy Sayers in her own way, although she didn't go on these funny little sort of use all these odd ways of showing Christian truth, but she was part of that, of the group that was influenced by him. And certainly J.R. Tolkien, who has become, I suppose he isn't so much a fad now, as he's, you know, anything after about 5 years or 4 years, things are, you know, they're old stuff in our day. But a few years ago, he was really hot, and the most important book that was on the bookshelves and the bookstores in even the biggest universities in the East were the three volumes of the Fellowship of the Ring series. And all these people are a part of the group that were influenced by George MacDonald and his way of giving all these deeply profound New Testament truths and different kind of incarnation from what we have been accustomed to. And that by doing that, he was able to snare these people into a new understanding of their own faith. Now, whether or not he was always doing this because he was trying to trap people, I don't think he was that kind of a hunter. I don't think he was, you know, off to catch everybody in that particular way. I think that every literary person, every artistic person is interested in finding a new form to express the reality that he has found, whether it's in Christ, as is true with George MacDonald, or if it's in some other kind of reality that some of the other writers and artists have discovered. They want to find their own kind of way of picturing or portraying this particular truth. And that's what George MacDonald was doing. And he had to do it because his imagination was such that it took wings and it flew around and it found all kinds of fascinating ways to express the life that meant dying and rising again, the life of struggle, the life of long search and the narrow gate and the opening up of the mysteries of the kingdom. The wonder, as far as I'm concerned anyway, of people like George MacDonald and C.S. Lewis and people like that, is that they take Christianity out of its kind of da-da-da-da-da-da-da kind of approach and make you realize that to belong to the kingdom of God is a tremendous and exciting thing, and it isn't just a matter of following certain little precepts, but that when you are related to the Holy Spirit, He's going to lead you in all kinds of strange and sometimes tangled paths in order for you to be the kind of person that you were meant to be. I just feel feel that the reason that Tolkien and C.S. Lewis too had such a great popularity is that the technology of our age has really kind of flattened us out so that we need something to, you know, make a finger snap. Something really to crack your mind a little bit and spur them and give them a kind of fire that opens up something new. And this is what these people do. And this is what they're meant to do. They're not meant to be taken literally. And you're not supposed to sit and say, now, in this story, he meant this. You know, this isn't the New Testament. But there are stories that are supposed to entertain you and delight you and interest you. But at the same time, they have a kind of a subliminal approach, if you want to put it that way. Something that is getting at you underneath. Kind of an unfair approach, in a way, because you're being attacked on two levels. You're being entertained at the same time that you're very subtly being kind of told something else in another way. And when you get through reading it, if you're not thinking more profoundly and reflectively, then it's a surprise because the books are written in that way. Now, I'm only going to talk about a couple of the stories today because the two that were the most popular and are the ones that you're most likely to run into are books that are going to be on the library shelves of most children's libraries, not in the church. Although they should be, but they aren't. I'm amazed at how much money goes into children's writing and how beautiful it looks and everything, but somehow so much of it has so little to feed the real imagination of the child. And it's no wonder we're going to finally develop into a bunch of, you know, computers, because you know you might as well get it out of a computer, because you don't have to have an image making process going on up here if all you're interested in is the answers. You don't even have to ask the questions, and if you do ask the questions, as we learned this summer at the computer sessions, you got to ask the right questions or the computer can't answer them. So you got to rephrase your question. Keep on changing your questions. Finally, you just quit asking questions and say, okay, I'll settle for all the answers. Hand them to me. I'll join. The two books that are the most popular and the ones that George MacDonald is well known for are At the Back of the North Wind. How many of you ever read that book when you were little? Anybody remember reading it? People that read it. At the Back of the North Wind, The Light Princess, and The Princess and Curdie, those were the three, weren't they, Marilyn? I think those are the three. Those were the stories that were very popular with the children in the 19th century England. The interesting thing was that they were published in very delightful forms. They were gilded, and they were, you know, the wealthy Victorian mamas could give their children, or the wealthy Victorian grandmamas could give their grandchildren the most beautiful editions of At the Back of the North Wind, or The Princess and Curdie, or The Little Light Princess, could be the most, you know, delightful gifts to give for Christmas. You know, those grandmamas never opened those books. They never read them. I'm sure the nannies, you know, the nursemaids might have read them out loud to the children, and they probably sort of brushed over the parts that they thought were boring. But the children later on did a good deal of reading in those books, because they were the ones that were available to them. Nowadays, we have everything in such simplified form, you know, that we don't have to read long paragraphs. You can get it in, you know, capsules and pictures, and that's it. But in these books, if those Victorian grandparents could have looked at them, they would have been shocked to discover that their whole caste system in England was being attacked in the most sly and clever way, because the coal miners' situation, the sadness of the deprivation and poverty of the children of the lower classes, all these things were being brought up, but not in the way that Charles Dickens did it, in which was, you know, bang, 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 you know, you've got it right here, you can see it, you know, look at what's happening in all our debtors' prisons, and look what's happening to our children. But oh no, George MacDonald did it in a far different manner. He just wove these great, wonderful fairy stories that the children would read and that they would be impressed by. They were, kids in those days didn't read David Copperfield. My goodness, that was, I'm sure, outside the list for small children in proper households. But George MacDonald, he was a Christian preacher. Well, of course, it's too bad that he had to leave the pulpit, but then he probably had to do it for his art's sake. And, you know, and I could just hear all those tea parties, you know, what a delightful man he was, and what delightful fantasies. They never read him any more than we read Luther. They didn't know what was in that book, but they gave it because, you know, the outside looked good. He was able to push the whole Christian message, the gospel of forgiveness, the love, the need of man, the way in which everybody had been stepped down in so-called Christian England. All these things were being handed out to the children in the form of a fairy story about a miner's son and a princess. And the miner's son was a noble lad, and he was the one that it took him a while before he found the faith which led him to see the inner world of the spirit. But when he did, he was the great sort of hero of the book. And it was the princess who was, I'll say this for George, he was not hard on royalty. He was harder on the middle class. But he did say that the princess, after all, felt very strongly that her word had to be good. So she was a God-fearing, upright princess, the little princess that was in this story. But the two of them were finally able to marry, an impossibility. But by the manner in which George MacDonald was able to weave these two together, you were not aware of the impossibility of it, because it wasn't the kind of fairy tale that, you know, you get from the Brothers Grimm, where you get a story, you know, the young lad goes and, you know, he climbs the glass mountain and he finally gets to the top, and there she is, and he gets her, and the father had promised him to her to him, therefore he caught her. But this doesn't happen in George MacDonald's stories. His stories are tremendously psychological. Children didn't know that. They didn't know that word, I'm sure, and neither did the nursemaids that were reading the stories aloud. But they were able to get into the working of the mind of the children, so that they got a real tremendous bang out of the plot and out of the life and out of the excitement. And in the process, it finally developed into a perfectly normal thing that the noble miner's boy and the princess should get married. Now, the way in which George MacDonald does this is something that I think is true of the Christian life, and I think this is why he fits into this study of the Christian imagination. He was able to have two worlds going all the time. There was the world of the everyday life that the person was living, And there was another world right alongside of that world that was continually invading the real world. And one novel that he wrote in Fantastes, which was one of his most popular adult fairy tales, the hero is standing in his bedroom and he's looking at his dresser. I don't know whether he's trying to decide what socks he's going to put on or what, but all of a sudden the drawers and the top of the dresser begin to fall apart, and there was a bowl of flowers on the top, and those flowers cascade over the top, and it becomes a pack of flowers that moves out of the wall and into a whole another world, which is very much similar to the kind of thing that C.S. Lewis uses in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, when the children there walk through a wardrobe or a chest of drawers right into an entirely another kind of world with a different kind of people, a population of animals and elves and whatnot in it, which is, and this is the kind of thing that happens in the Fantastics. The same thing happens in The Princess and Curdy, and the prince and the Little Light Princess. The little princess goes from she goes through a number of different experiences and finally finds her way up to an attic room where all of a sudden when she comes into it, there's a great light in there, and there's a bed of roses that are burning, if you can imagine something like this. I suppose maybe if you'd seen the red vine hanging over our balcony up there on our chalet, maybe get the same feeling of something really burning. We feel that way in the fall, seeing some of the trees. They look like they're on fire. Well, apparently these roses were really burning because they were baked in the room, and actually flames were coming out of them. Well, when the little princess comes up into this room, she is given by this grandmother, whom she'd never seen before, a little bit of thread, which is attached to a fire opal, which she has always had on her hand. And this thread is going to be the way in which she's going to find her way through all the vicissitudes of life. Well, actually, this is part of the way in which what sounds like it's going to be a perfectly normal story suddenly moves into another realm, and she goes into mines, she goes down under the earth, she saves Curdy from being imprisoned by the goblins, and all kinds of things with the help of this little thread, which is, as Dorothy Goblin himself once said, the thread of imagination, but also the thread of faith. And as you read these stories, you begin to say to yourself, well, you know, the Holy Spirit operates in very strange ways too, if you let yourself go, and if you let him operate with you, you're let into a lot of tangly things that you don't think you're ever going to get out of. And if it weren't for a kind of a thread of faith, you wouldn't get out of them. And I think the reason our lives are so dull as Christians is that we don't let the Holy Spirit in enough, really, really, to operate with us and do something exciting with our lives. I don't think our lives are meant to be dull or unrisky and without venture. And certainly George MacDonald's books point this up very clearly, that life is full of venture and excitement and mystery. And if you think you've got things figured out, then you better read George MacDonald and say, is he really a Christian? How can he write all this stuff? Did any of you ever see At the Back of the North Wind? Have you ever seen that book? That was a very popular fairy tale when I was young, and it was about a little boy named Diamond who lived in a coach house. And out of a little chink in the coach house, the north wind came in
and blew herself into the room, and when she got into the room, she was a gray woman with long hair. And she told Diamond she was going to take him on a trip. And he said, I want to go to the back of the North Wind. And she said, I can't take you there because how can I get at my back? Which is a very obvious statement. How do you get to your back? You can't. She said, all I can do, I can take you up there, but then I have to sit on the doorstep and just listen to the voices behind me because I can't get there. But I can take you that far. And so she did. And the adventures that Diamond had, the little boy, with this strange woman, the North Wind, is, you know, weird, peculiar, but exciting. And why we have to think in terms of something like, my days, the Christian books were things like Grace Livingston Hill and what else? Well, The Bishop's Mantle, that was a good book, but I mean, they were all dealing with just what we deal with all the time, and you never got a kind of a feeling that you were in something bigger than just this immediate battle, that there was a cosmic battle going on too, and that you were also a part of that. This is what you get out of imaginative writing when it's in the Christian tradition. And the exciting thing about George MacDonald and his influence on the writers who followed him was that he had this total and passionate commitment to doing his own thing. He wasn't afraid to write these books and these stories that were, from the style point of view, they were certainly not in the category of the really good writers of the period, but from the point of view of originality, they far exceeded most of the people that wrote in 19th century England. And I think that's because he was a Christian. Because to me, when you are related to Jesus Christ, you're original. You don't repeat in applied kind of glibness what somebody else is saying. You're not satisfied with what somebody else said about something. You say, I'm going to find out for myself. I'm going to read the book myself. I'm going to expose myself to it. That's what makes me, as I say, that's why I brought Luther up at the beginning, because I get so mad at people just being satisfied hearing about what somebody else said about Luther. I don't care. Even Roland Bainton, dearly as I loved him, I never had read anything by Roland Bainton until he came here, because I don't like to read books about somebody if you can read the books by the person themselves. And this is why I think George MacDonald is exciting, why he's original, and why I think that our Lutheran church needs a good shake-up. Just maybe a good return to Jesus Christ himself in an original way instead of a derivative one. Instead of always, figuring, well, this is the way it's supposed to be and I can't be different from that, so I'll go along with it. Those of you who are retired, I think have got a lot more oomph and independence because of the fact that you realize you don't have to worry whether you've got it made or not anymore. You're not worried about your particular status or anything. Trouble with those of us in our age bracket, we're still, worried about what people are going to think about us and whether we're going to be criticized and maybe we might be misunderstood. Well, George MacDonald was misunderstood all right. He didn't get any money for preaching, and as I say, he got kicked out of his churches because they couldn't stand it. But I wonder if we don't have to take that chance and take that risk that people are going to misunderstand you, and that you're not always going to be as clear as crystal, as clear as you know, an ABC. I thought the example that Brother Lawrence is carrying on, that's because he does such menial work, Brother Lawrence does. He does the sauna fire and takes care of a lot of things. But I thought that thought of the crystal Christ was a fascinating one, because crystal sparkles and it's lots of different colors, and it doesn't remain just one thing. And I think this is what you have to be involved with when you start shipping out on the sea of imagination. You've got to realize that there's going to be a lot of variance and a lot of many colored things about your experience.
Tell them about the word even for gifts of grace that just is that. That's interesting. The New Testament word for gifts of grace is very colored. Mm-hmm. All the different colors that a crystal gives out. And that's how Christians should be. They should be that different. That they're that sparklingly different. And nobody's in any way like another. You can't be a law to each other because each of you are so different. You can't be your wife or you can't be your grandmother. It's just the wonderful thing about the variegated grace of God, is the way the King James translates variegated, but it means
that's
it's multicolored.
That's a good word, actually, if we did, except that we don't use it very often. But it is true, and I remember when we looked at that word the first time, and I talked to Rudy Edmund about it, and he said Carol and I had been studying the word, and we looked it up and found that it was the word in Greek that was used for the description of rocks, geological rocks, the sparkle, the crystalline sparkle on the stone was what that word was. And it was kind of fun because Rudy said, well, it was so true. And those of you who were here this summer, and I wish that we had that, we should have had a copy of those slides of Larry Collins's, because this is what I was thinking of in terms of George MacDonald when I was reading him this morning. In particular, I was thinking of Larry Collins and his slides on the different stones, that they look like perfectly normal stones, and when they're polarized with light, and you put light on them, look through them, they have the most fascinating colors and patterns inside of them. You wouldn't believe it from the outside. Sort of like what Bob Pillow was talking about yesterday, about the rocks in his, up here and the rocks in Little Robin's play box at home. The same rocks, but they're different up here. And the interesting thing is that Father Paul looks at them up here, whereas at home he doesn't even pay attention to them. But George MacDonald had a fascination for rocks and for mining and for the underground life. And I think that's another thing that fascinates me about him. Up here especially, because he thought that the whole world underground was peopled with all kinds of little figures, goblins and little men with soft feet and clawy hands, and the way you finally got to those men was by standing on your soft feet. That's where they were finally killed. But the excitement of the underground, of the mine, and the mystery of it, was no doubt part of his feeling of trying to give people a sense that they were walking on not just grass and neat little paths and privet hedges and formal gardens. Underneath there was a seething mass of
a fire at the center, and there was all that marvelous stone and, you know, silver and gold and diamonds and all that. It was all underneath, and people in Victorian England were just, you know, completely immune to it. Well, actually, up here we get kind of immune to it too. We look right at it all the time, never thinking that inside, you know, the copper and buckskin and Bonanza, maybe in some parts of Dumbbell, there are some really neat caverns with silver and gold and diamonds trickling around. You never can tell. Of course, from last night, I understand diamonds wouldn't be in this kind of property. You have to have a look.
Sometimes C.S. Lewis had in his children's books too, he had the same kind of fascination. I mean, he talked about the living minerals. He'd say, like, they're, you know, below this, you know, this fancy land of Narnia, there were rubies that you could squeeze and you could drink the juices, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was so much alive. And so yeah. It was a fascination.
Yeah, fruits, sort of a fruity jewel.
Did you tell him that Augsburg had published Diary of an Old Soul?
I'm just trying to show it to him.
So our establishment has published him, in order to get him back into print, because he's out of print on so much of this.
I just want to read this, just the description of the mine, inside of a mountain, so that you get an idea of his style and how really, you know, I'm sure you'd probably go to sleep on him if you read very much of him, because we're just not used to this kind of writing. But it's fun to run into every once in a while. But the inside of the mountains, who shall tell what lies there? Caverns of awfulest solitude, their walls miles thick, sparkling with ores of gold or silver, copper or iron, tin or mercury, studded perhaps with precious stones, perhaps a brook with eyeless fish in it, running, ceaseless and cold and babbling, through banks crusted with carbuncles and golden topazes, or over a gravel of which some of the stones are rubies and emeralds, perhaps diamonds and sapphires, all waiting to flash, waiting for millions of ages. Yeah, you feel a little differently about the ground you walk on. You know, there's something up here that's supposed to be, you know, perching. And somebody like this, if you can just take time and not have to feel like you gotta go through something, it'll work on you like leaven. But anybody that's made bread knows it takes a while. It takes a while to make a baby, it takes a while to make bread, and it takes a while to fertilize the imagination. And that's what...
But is it always good to have it fertilized? I was thinking, I walk all alone now at night from that other sound below the river up there. I always wish that you hadn't told me about McDonald's trees, because you always feel those trees are going to reach down.
I didn't know if I should mention that. After we went up to Holden Lake the first time, I said to him, there's one forest before you get to Holden Lake that has a lot of really gnarled, kind of stripped trees in it, you know, they're kind of, and really, they are, it's not hard to figure out how McDonald would understand them as, you know, reaching out fingers. And he has this fantastic, the trees have such terrible personalities that you just get...
They are sour.
Well, a couple of them are nice, but a lot of them are really kind of frightening. This was for adults, though, and adults are brave.
Yeah.
But not some of them are brave. Most of them. I wouldn't be caught dead walking up the lake at night. Let's say I thought Missy was a brave girl. But at the same time that George MacDonald is writing this kind of thing and spinning out all these of ideas and plots and exciting stories, which I put soul sort of off and on, not too well, but kind of. He got a lot of gifts, you know, like Holden, you know, I'm sure he had a lot of founders and supported him. But maybe this is something that the women's auxiliary of Holden could do, I don't know, but his wife finally decided that their money was so slow in coming in that she decided they have to start putting on theatrical performances. So they ran a drama group every summer. All summer long, they put on performances of plays, some of them that he had written and adapted, and some of them that were popular, but most of them were things that he had done. And they were able, by that means, to make it possible not to make enough money to do anything pay a lot of their debts, I suppose, but they were always able to go back to Italy in the winter. Well, I shouldn't be so snippy about it, because poor man, he had tuberculosis, and most of his children had tuberculosis, and his parents, his sisters, and I think his mother had died of tuberculosis, so he really did need to make money enough to go to Italy and stay warm. And I guess from what everybody says about the climate in England, anything would be better than an English winter. And they did live in England, in Italy, in the winter. And I wanted to read just a little bit from a description of the Christmas that they had in Italy, in the big house that they lived in there. Because this man and his family, and he had about 9 children, I think, varying degrees of health, no doubt. But this man wasn't just a writer. He didn't just sit like, you know, writing all by himself and have nothing to do with his children or his wife or anything. The whole lifestyle was just overflowing with Christian imagination. Believe me, there wasn't very much dullness in that family life. And they called George MacDonald Mr. Greatheart. That was the name that he had. He had written a story about Mr. Greatheart, and his children referred to him that way, many of his friends. And at the when he was in when they were living at this beautiful home in Italy, they always had, I don't know where they got all that money. They always had such fine homes, big, beautiful places. And I think to myself, well, he can't have been that way off. I always thought he was probably dying of poverty all the time. But at that time, there were a lot of wealthy people who were kind of like patrons or angels, what we have in today's world, who support art forms and art people. And like Lady Byron gave him a lot of money, and even a member of the royal family, along with a whole group of artists and writers, got together and got a fundraise to support him for a while, because he was such a popular person with the people who were themselves imaginative and who appreciated what he was doing. The congregations couldn't stand him, but some people did, and therefore he was able to be of some, you know, have some kind of comfort and luxury to a certain extent, although not in our meaning of the word. He was able to live a life of hospitality for others. And this is the keynote, I think, of what I consider the greatest thing about him, is that he was not a recluse. He was not a withdrawing kind of genius. He was a man for whom the love of Christ spilled over in writing, in stories for children, novels for adults, poetry, prayers, sermons, articles, all kinds of things like that, but also in terms of just the people that he was with. I wanted to read two things to you. One, the description of their Christmas, and one, a poem that he wrote, he and his wife sent out when they were going to invite some people to a party, a whole lot of people to a party. And it was so funny.
You know, it reminds me of a lot like Herb Brogreen, really.
Yeah, he's kind of like that.
But sure. Here the establishment can make room for him because it gets tired of its own dull publications and it pulls somebody in who simply never does anything the same way twice.
Yeah.
And he just plain loves that. Now, he poked up here for just 2 days a week ago. And when he was through, everybody stood up and cheered and clapped and everything else. And I guess it was about the zaniest moment of the whole summer and wonderful. And he just has this gift to kind of just release people of all their intimidations and inhibitions and get going. And I think George MacDonald had this. And not least writing these silly children's stories, I think, helped set him free. Perhaps writing for children helps most of all. You've got to be like a little child to enter the kingdom, and you suddenly realize you've got to be.
That's right. He certainly, all of his stories have the symbol of somebody finally becoming a child, and it's through the child that the person finally enters into the meaning of the mystery of the kingdom. But, I hate to talk about this because this is sad, but my mother, besides her domestic surprises and enterprises, played the organ in church and, as already said, trained the choir. Hear me, it seems to me it's enough that she could run the dramatic society and have all those kids, but then besides that she played the organ and directed the choir. I feel like she was too much of a paragon, but anyway. Another fine instance is before me of my mother's resource in entertainment. If the idea was my mother's, the verses of invitation were my father's, and these explain the whole thing. Please come on Monday, the day after Sunday. And mind that you start with something to part with. A fire shall be ready, glowing and steady, to receive it and burn it and never return it. Books that are silly, clothes outworn and chilly, hats, umbrellas, or bonnets, dull letters, bad sonnets, what the air to the furnace by nature calls burn us, an ancient bad temper, will be noted no damper. The fire will not scorn it, but glory to burn it. Here every bad picture finds refuge from stricture, or any old grudge that refuses to budge will make it the tomb for all sorts of gloom, the out-of-door path for every man's wrath, all lying and hinting, all jealous squinting, all unkind talking and each other balking. Let the fire's holy actions turn to ghostly abstractions. All antimacassars, all moth egg amassers, old gloves and old feathers, old shoes and old leathers, greasy or tarry, bring all you can carry. We would not deceive you, the fire shall relieve you. The world will feel better, and so be your debtor. Be welcome then, very, and come. And be near. George and Louisa MacDonald, bonfire at 7 p.m., dancing at 8. This was New Year's Eve. That was a neat idea.
Should do it here.
Now, why shouldn't people have some ideas like that? But, well, of course, there are always these fire regulations. At home, you know, you're not allowed to burn trash anymore because of pollution. And I agree. I'm certainly sympathetic with that. But, you know, you just don't ever try to do anything different. Now I want to tell you, I want to just give you this little description of their Christmas Eve. On Christmas Eve, we were dining in our little room, looking on the olive, and we heard the sound of many voices, and looking out, lamps glimmered among the trees, and figures carrying lanterns and sheets of music. Who should they be but the dear MacDonald family visiting the houses of all the invalids in the place, to sing them carols and bring them the glad tidings of Christmas. The next day, they had beautiful tableaus of the Annunciation, the stable, the angels, and the shepherds, ending up with the San Sisto Madonna in their wonderful room in the Caraggio, and they had invited the peasants to come and enjoy this for them novel representation of the event of the Blessed Christmastide. That house, Caraggio, is the very heart of Bordighera, the rich core of it, always raying out to all around and gathering them to itself. We have weekly poetry readings there, enriched by the thoughts and the voice of the reader. Sometimes there were concerts and theatricals for our amusement or for some charity. And this winter there was a concert for the completion of the church for the poor of the marina. This delighted the good Father Giacomo, the village priest, as a mark of true Christian feeling and Catholicity. They were really ecumenical. And how can I describe the Sunday evenings? If you don't mind, but now I want you to remember that this is the way they lived. I mean, this was the kind of a way in which they overflowed. They didn't have to have, you know, all the overstuffed furniture that was part of the Victorian style. If you don't mind a house guiltless of furniture, except for hired necessities, we hope you will come and stay with us. We shall be so disappointed if you don't. I'm quite sure you would like our new abode. Everyone is quite happy. We are all steeped to our elbows in black paint and colored stains from wood. Mama and Grace are doing the walls of Mama's little sitting room, a dull red with eucalyptus leaves all over it. I have been upholsterer all the week, and out of boxes in turkey red have turned out some very neat things in chairs and ottomans, and have nearly lost the use of the tips of my fingers, thanks to the hammer and nails. We had some Christmas tableaus last week, the Annunciation and so on. We had all the English one day, and about 100 of the Italians the next, the people about, anyone that happened. The adopted babies, they adopted two or three children along with their nine. The adopted babies flourish and their mother is no worse. They made a lovely Christ child in St. John the other night and were quite good.
Now there you wonder how he does it and how much did he have in furniture, you see.
But this is it.
They made his chairs out of the boxes. I mean, this is the thing gets me. Once
he didn't do it, though. He didn't make it. This was one of the daughters.
Well, that's smart. He had a daughter. That could do something. I have a daughter can do something.
I just didn't want you to feel bad about
the car. No, I'm glad the children again. But people asked us how we could take our children. I convinced the whole gang about 3 weeks ago to take their families to Europe on trips. And they were wondering how we could afford it and so on. And so I'd ask the preacher, ask him, well, how much have you spent on cars in your life? So far, I've spent $2,700 on mine. Well, like they said, I've spent that much on one. Well, this is one reason we had it. The other reason was we had in our home at that moment total value of furniture less than $700, including the one big expenditure of $330 for a Magnavox when it went on sale when TV came out. But that's how you can do it. It depends on what you want to do it for. See, my Aunt Comfort told me years before, she said, well, you can put it in your stomach and on your back if you want to, or in your mind and in your spirit. She says, it just depends on which way you want to go, but you can't go both routes, you know. And I think this is true for most of us. We can't. And I think this about the village, if people say it's too expensive to afford, well, maybe it's the kind that they can't afford to go without, and maybe they can, but what would mean for their families to just actually fling it a little bit, you know? I mean, more to their family than getting a new model car, surely. I know that. Maybe not more to the dad. But I'm sure that's the way McDonald's made it. They just did. The Hong's the same way. The Art Halverson's the same way. We were all over at the same time with six kids each, and that's why this article in the Lutheran Standard, and where do these people get all their money to live in Europe? But we were spending it that way. Sends me the creations with
their imagination does help you. You know, if you feel like you have to do things always, you know, the right way, why you don't have the independence to, you know, make do. I want to read this one little description of the moon just to get another idea of the way he describes things, because it's so funny just to have in your head the moonshot. And this is the way he described the way they looked at the moon and the way the children looked at the moon. Nanny is the nursery, and this is the story, and this is part of At the Back of the North Wind. Nanny dreams that the moon descends to her while she's in a summer house in the garden, and the little old man steps out of a door in the side of it and summons her in. Inside the moon is a charming little house with blue windows and white curtains, and the mistress of the place looking out of one of them. It takes off from the grounds, and Nanny and the old man look back at the earth through the windows. Her work is to keep the windows polished. The moon is full of passages, And at the end of one, Nanny listens at her door and hears a hum. My lady's bees collect honey from the stars. While cleaning the windows on the outside of the moon, Nanny climbs into the room where the bees are kept and accidentally lets them out, contrary to orders. The lady of the moon is angry and says that Nanny won't do it. She's only fit for the mud. When she wakes up, pulling at a ring she has been loaned by a kind visiting lady at the hospital. The moon lady says she's stolen it. And this is, you know, this is just the end of that little series. But you know, this is the way, of course, you young people, you know, I'm sure you never looked at the moon that way, but we had, you know, when we grew up, we had a lot of nice, fairy-like imaginations about the moon. And, you know, there was a place up there, maybe it had something in it. Maybe there was, you know, maybe we could explore the inside of it, like the inside of these mountains. But that new generation,
they're going to live inside of it.
I'd like to have you look at these two books, because these are probably the two books that you're most likely to be exposed to and that you might buy. One of them is an anthology of George MacDonald by C.S. Lewis, who gives total credit to MacDonald for his awakening as a Christian in the world of imagination. And the other one is The Diary of an Old Soul, which was printed by Augsburg because Al Rogers insisted that it was a book that should be printed by them, since it was the favorite book of his son, who was killed in an accident on his way back from a two-year Rhodes scholarship. This Diary of an Old Soul, I just can't recommend highly enough. There's a poem for each day in the year, a little sonnet, and they're all meditative, devotional, and they are the kind of thing that you have to stop when you read it. It's not, you know, God's minute. It's really something that's going to take a little fertilization in your own mind, and it does a lot for your praying and for your life in the spirit. And then this wonderful little book of the excerpts from all sorts of things from George MacDonald's books. I've got a shelf that's this long that I haven't read of all George MacDonald's all his different books, and he has a lot of his novels and stories are wordy and far too descriptive, and I don't ever expect to read them all. But there are a lot of wonderful passages in, you know, sort of nuggeted in all these mountains of prose. And C.S. Lewis has mined them out and found some really beautiful ones
Now, when we're thinking of using our poster for this year is worth quoting. Do you have it there? The reason we desire liberty of our own is because we do not know the liberty that comes from thee.
I didn't get that outline, but... That's a very good one. Another one that I thought was very good is on holy laughter. And since holy hilarity is something that the man who upholstered these benches gave us one day went down the boat, was going out of the village, and sent $25 back to Carol without writing his name, and he said, for the holy hilarity of Holden Village. And he had found that, you know, that Jesus Christ was here, and he could really laugh again. He'd been a very unhappy man for almost all his life. And this is a wonderful thing that George MacDonald says about holy laughter, holy hilarity. It is the heart that is not yet sure of its God that is afraid to laugh in his presence. That's a wonderful thought. Well, I don't know if there's anything that you'd like to ask about. I've gone for an hour now. I think that an hour should be enough. I've waited for a long time for you to.
We've held them up. I'm sorry.
No, they were, yeah. Not in the store, but I'll put
we'll
them.
Order them.
I'll put them over in Koinonia, on the table there. You can take them out and read them, and then.
Yeah.
No. But we'll order and send.
You can get them at Oxford.
Some are. That one we may have to get from England, but they're cheaper from England. We'll no. order any from.
No, this isn't. This is a dolphin book.
Well, that's a dolphin.
This is available. I think you can. This is put out by Doubleday, so we can get this one.
But because of the influence of a fellow like George MacDonald, you have, when you go to Oxford, I think one of the most wonderful things in Europe to see, and if you don't see it, you miss something, and remind Judy, she isn't here to see it, they have a children's bookstore, just for children. Their size with everything in children's literature, and their size chairs. And so the little kids can come in and browse to their own bookstore. You know, oh, it's simply fascinating. And I would guess, at least 10,000 titles. It's just wonderful. So don't miss it when you're in Oxford. It's just one of the grand things in this world to have an actual bookstore built for children their size of all their books on the shelves. That's the same screwball, you know, that Plebe was an agnostic and then he woke up one morning at Oxford and had to give thanks. As we else did I give thanks to? But the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who became a Christian. And he has the greatest bookstore in the world. This was written up in New Yorker 2 years ago, those who read New Yorker. Then he's built a separate bookstore just for children. Well, that's this MacDonald C.S. Lewis influence on the English life.
Are there any other questions? You're free to leave if you want to. If any of you want to talk about it anymore, I can read you a few more of these. Quotes, he has some great things in here that are just delightful.
I have to go and do some letters, but you should also, I was just thinking, tell them some more of these children's books, since these are people with grandchildren. I was just thinking those that Andy always orders every time I go over there that you've got to get from over there.
Oh, the Tintin books.
Tintin books.
Well, I decided that maybe I shouldn't have missed, but I think we should turn off the tape.
No, I kept it for too. I was worried they didn't have you on, so I was going to go over and get it.
Oh, they had it on.